Well, it is a great pleasure to have Henrik Schoenfeld for my latest nostalgia interview. And Henrik, I think you're, as we were just discussing, the third person from the School of Architecture here at the University of Kent that I've interviewed for my podcast. And do you want to say a little bit about, first of all, how long you've been at the University of Kent?
I mean, I arrived in September 2011, so after finishing my PhD at the University of Cambridge. So it was actually quite interesting while I was finishing up my PhD. I was applying for junior research fellowships around Cambridge. And then I saw that there was a lectureship for architecture advertised at the University of Kent. And I thought, that looked very interesting. That sounded something quite fitting to my background, because it was this lectureship in sustainable architecture. So I applied for it, and I got it, actually. I was very surprised about this, a full-time job.
Because I was just thinking that architecture must have really taken off at Kent around that sort of time, because I think it migrated, didn't it, to the University of Kent around that sort of period.
So when I was there, I think it's been running for about 5 years.
Okay.
So I was the second generations of new academics that were brought in, particularly to build up the research side of their school. So to bring people who have PhDs, who have research experiences, and then developing the postgraduate programs. So we have a specialist MSc in sustainable architecture, for instance. It's been running now for over 10 years and is doing quite well as a program.
Yeah, and so you were at Cambridge before that. So it sounds like this was a perfect fit, because I mean, you know, it's always that thing. You know, everyone always thinks about, you know, the dream job or the sort of or the perfect application of what you're doing. And I mean, I came here in 2004, and I was for about 3 or 4 years a lecturer in applied theology, and that was the job that I sort of was given. And I thought actually it kind of was a good fit, but it was more that I was able to define myself through that title, but it wasn't the title, if you like, that I brought with me up to that point. But in your case, it sounds as though there would have been quite a good fit between the work, I'm assuming that sustainability is something that you work on, and the job title, as it were, that you apply for.
Yeah, I mean, my PhD was actually on the history of the environment in architecture, so looking at the question that we have today about climate change and so on are very often framed through a very contemporary lens. And my interest actually is trying to establish a dialogue between a historical perspective and a contemporary perspective on sustainability. And that becomes particularly interesting when you're looking at historic buildings, because historic buildings were also influenced by particular environmental thinking that's very distinct to its time.
Yeah.
So the concerns that were driving these particular environmental questions changed over time, but there's still, even if you're going back 200 years, you will find records in archives where people talk about the environment in relationship to buildings and what the role of technology is, what the role of the architecture is in creating adequate environments for people to live in, sort of climatically, in terms of ventilation, etc., questions of energy and so on. So these questions have a historical dimension, and I'm very, very interested in exploring that sort of relationship between our contemporary engagement with these questions and how people in the past did it, and how those two understandings can help us to deal with historic buildings in a more sympathetic way with them.
Because it's fascinating, because I mean, I remember growing up and particularly around the late 80s, when suddenly talk of green consciousness or ecological consciousness, climate change, they really came onto the agenda around that kind of period. And I think it's easy, and well, I say easy, but it's, you're actually doing it. But to actually then sort of look back and say, but even if we weren't using those buzzwords then, I suppose it's the same with issues around diversity or inclusivity. You know, the number of films I watch where they might be set in the 19th century, like The Greatest Showman, but they're very much sort of driven by the sort of the mores and the standards and the values of today. But in your case, is there that sense of looking back over a different period and trying to then sort of read into it what we are interested in today? Or was that there in its own sort of, with its own integrity, that can be transplanted from that era, from that period, into today's climate?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I think to some degree, yes. But this is not a literal transplantation, I guess. It's more a critical re-engagement with pathways of thinking about these problems. I mean, it's just seeing that, essentially seeing is that there's a tradition. So, but by the way, what I describe it, what I find really interesting is that we are, oh, everybody was interested today in sustainability or in environmental design of buildings. In some ways, even if they're not aware of, they're part of a tradition. And even if we don't think it along those terms, but environmental design, to me, is actually part of an architectural tradition that one can trace back a long time. So what I'm kind of interesting is what we're doing today are adding to that tradition. And if we are able to embed our current ways of thinking into that more historical angle, we can probably try to connect with it more. When actually seeing actually what the Victorians did here, we need to go back to that and think, what did they actually think about how to keep a building cool in the summer? What did they do? And are some of these techniques they were using, or even if it's just the concepts behind it, in some ways usable today? Could we learn from them? And what comes with this very often is this question of simple solutions, where often where the buildings themselves were designed to keep cool rather than relying on a lot of technology to supplement them. Because that's one of the key drivers at the moment of energy use in buildings. It's actually the over-reliance on mechanical systems to make poorly adapted buildings suitable for the climate. Even if we go into the Middle East and we're seeing these glass towers being built in extremely hot, arid climate conditions, they rely on extensive technological systems in order to be inhabitable, essentially mechanical ventilation, air conditioning. So, and that is a completely different attitude towards thinking about the relationship between architecture and climate compared to a more traditional building that would have been built in the same region at the time, where they didn't have those technologies, so they had to be more resourceful in terms of using the architectural approaches to keeping buildings cool, thick walls, for instance, smaller windows, providing shades over streets and courtyards, etc. So there is a sort of tradition, a past tradition of living with hot climates that can be somewhat superseded by modern technological developments, which promotes this idea that we no longer need to live with those constraints, but we actually have that freedom to create new types of buildings. But as a trade-off, we were then becoming highly reliant on cheap energy supplies, in this case fossil fuels in most cases, to drive these systems.
Yeah, and there's the irony, isn't there? And I learnt it myself when, not once but twice, I bought a home that was a new build, and I was thinking, oh, it's a new build, so it's got no history, it's going to be wonderful, and the no architectural problems. How wrong I was. And you think, you know, that some of these, although they need a lot of repair, think of Canterbury Cathedral, which always has some obviously work going on in it, but some of those buildings from a different era have lasted in a way that a lot of these modern buildings will not. And I find that interesting, that technology moves on, and yet it sounds, from what you're saying, there's a sense that we need to learn more and should learn better from what previous generations did, than the idea that we can let technology drive our current, you know, architectural building plans.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what the particular problem in the UK, I guess, is the standard of housing construction is very low.
Yeah.
I mean, there's particularly the volume house builders, they're not interested in promoting good standards of construction.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I would sort of, an interesting thing is currently a debate that actually a lot of the buildings that are currently built will become a liability because they need to be heavily retrofitted in the future to make them less dependent on energy and fossil fuels, etc. Because they're not really harnessing the new technology, like passive house, for instance, which is a concept that was originally developed in Germany, which achieves buildings that don't rely on the conventional heating system anymore because they're so efficient. So that's actually perfectly feasible. There have been tens of thousands of buildings being built in that standard around the world, but it doesn't become necessarily a standard for the volume house builders across the UK. So you're dealing with actually quite low quality construction and low standards of thermal insulation, etc., and energy efficiency. So this is a paradox, isn't it? That in some way the commercial models that underlies those volume house builders is not to raise standards and achieve sustainable buildings in the sense that they are durable, that they are efficient. That's not really the paradigm that they're based on.
And did this interest, I mean, this passion, I should say, did that Obviously, you did a PhD in this, but is that an area that sort of goes back to a much earlier sort of period? Have you always been interested in these sort of questions? Have you always been interested in the sort of the research of how we can learn from what previous generations did, and in many cases did better? So what is the spark for you that generated this interest?
Yeah, I think that's actually, I grew up, because I was born in Germany and grew up in Germany in a former industrial town or city called Hamm, between Dortmund and Münster, which is sort of the eastern end of the Ruhr district, which is essentially the Rust Belt of Germany. And this area is really interesting because it has a lot of heritage, industrial heritage. So growing up, it was really fascinating to see how actually facilities that have architectural merit in their own right, these industrial heritage, was actually valued by people in trying to find ways of giving them a second life. So seeing that actually heritage doesn't always need to mean that we're looking at medieval cathedrals or 18th century country houses or royal palaces, but that it can also be this industrial heritage. And then there's a whole culture that emerged in the Ruhr area of actually seeing this as catalyst for development. So type of development is not entirely economical, but it's also to do with engaging with the history and identity of the place. So what I find it really interesting is you have this industrial site, and in some ways these industrial sites are incredibly violent interventions into the natural environment, but now they become a sort of cultural heritage, and how landscape architects and thought about the impact that these have made on the environment, and how we can start using that as a way of engaging with some sort of questions about sustainable and the natural environment. So, for instance, this idea that the slag heap on an industrial site was highly contaminated and actually probably a risk to life could actually be transformed into a landscape where ecologists and landscape architects would work together trying to explore how we can actually create a new kind of nature in these rather extreme hostile physical environments. So these what I find really interesting is that these buildings essentially sparked up a conversation around regeneration, ecological regeneration in on this brownfield site. And there was this huge project called the Emscher Park, which is essentially a river that used to connect a large number of industrial complexes and acted pretty much as a sewer.
Yeah.
So it's highly contaminated, but as part of this regeneration project, they literally cleaned up the river, but also then transformed all these former industrial sites along it into new developments with a very strong ecological focus. So they become public parks that have ecological themes. There's a social element to that. They're creating social spaces for the neighborhoods, a very densely populated area. So there's an engagement with this sort of question of sustainability in some ways with something that's heritage. And then alongside that, you will see at the same time that there were a lot of experimentation with modern sustainable architecture, with office buildings, housing designed to be very low energy, utilizing renewable technologies, integrating into facade. And these buildings were, you could see going up everywhere.
Yeah.
So there was a culture of sustainability on a number of levels. And I found that very inspiring. And also, I live myself in a house that sits on a former industrial site, because my granddad's family used to have a large company making machinery. So they had this complex. It's now a park.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
You grew up in this land. I mean, I think, you know, when you mentioned the industrialized Germany, the image that came to mind was watching the Wim Wenders film, The Wings of Desire, which was set in that period before the integration of East and West Berlin. I've got to ask then, what happened to that industrialized landscape in which you grew up? Is it now a park? Was it transformed into something different and better? If you go back there, do you recognize the home from all those years ago?
Yeah, so my mum still lives in the house.
Yeah.
So it's It's a very large house, but it's not surrounded by buildings, so the city starts to actually grew up around the building. So now they actually so what I have to say is that actually I never experienced firsthand the factory anymore because all of that had gone before I was born. What I thought was fascinating, my granddad used to talk a lot about it and had also records. So he had photographs in the basement. So he had in the basement all the photographs of the type of technology, the development. They had patents. They had technical drawings. And my granddad didn't really think about it as something that should be worth preserving. But I was really interested. Yeah. So I was collecting these things along the way as my granddad had all these drawers full of these records that he would get occasionally out and tell me about. But wouldn't really value, and sometimes would just allow things to decay in the moist basement. So I was sort of taking some of this stuff up into my bedroom when I was growing up.
Well, and I bet you don't regret that. Now I've got to ask you: do you still have those records? I'm guessing the answer is yes.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so you preserve them, and I'm guessing that they, in some way, either directly or indirectly, led to the research that you've gone on to do. It sounds as though, you know, I mean, my grandfather, in his later years, so I mean, when he was in his 80s, he started writing up his life story. And I've got in this very office, I've got all the things that he wrote. But, you know, it's things like that, those sort of artefacts that somebody else might just get rid of, or they might just, you know, think it's superfluous or taking up space, or, you know, nothing to do with, you know, the next generation. But actually, you've established that, you know, you've created, or, well, not you've created, but you've sustained effectively an archive based on a time and place that no longer exists in that form. You've got the proof that it did exist, but you've actually got the building blocks or whatever the metaphor might be for something that actually to a generation growing up now might find this, you know, hard to believe that people would have lived in circumstances akin to what you're describing.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about my... Recently, my mum got a gift from someone who used to work in my great-granddad's house. So staff, essentially. They had staff, because they were very wealthy at that time, because the factory was doing quite well, so they built themselves two big villas. One was destroyed in the war, the other one survived, and that's the one I grew up in.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were several generations of us living together. I really loved that they had my grandparents living on the ground floor. Then my mum and dad, we were living up on the floor. Yeah. And then I also had great uncle living next, also in the house. So there was always a lot of people in the house. So it's not wasn't this typical nuclear family.
Yeah.
Type of model, which I find very difficult as a concept personally, actually having grown up that way. So it's just pure coincidence that somebody in the neighborhood bought my mum a photo album that showed the villa that was destroyed in the Second World War before it was destroyed, and with people in the garden. And my mum would recognize some of these people in the photograph, which I wouldn't recognize because there were people that were alive and she was growing up who are no longer alive now and I've never met. So there was suddenly, over time, people would bring things along where we would have no records of. So we literally had probably a couple of photographs of that second villa. But now we had lots of photographs and showing it also in lived in.
And do you think, were they bringing them to you because they could tell that it might be of use to you? In other words, is it the case that suddenly they were encouraged to say, well, what have we got in our attics? What have we got in our basements or wherever it might be? It sounded as though you were a conduit for this. Through your mum, okay.
Yeah, through my mum.
Okay.
And through a friend of my mum.
Yeah.
That the connection was made, so they knew somebody who had a personal connection to the place. Because I haven't lived in Germany for over 20 years now, so I don't really have actually connections anymore locally very much where I grew up. So I visit my mum as well 2 or 3 times a year.
Yeah,
a few other relatives and friends, etc. But otherwise, actually, I've really now really settled here in the UK because I really did all my studies here. Yeah. So, and this is actually at the moment quite an interesting period, also with the pandemic and then Brexit. Triggered quite a lot of thinking about identity, actually. How, having built, arrived in the UK, studying here, and then having an academic career to get a professorship 4 years ago, and also working on the project in Parliament, which is, I mean, that's a, particular of my background. I've also got British citizenship, so I've got dual nationality. I'm working on the largest conservation project in the UK. With the restoration renewal of the Palace of Westminster.
Oh, you're involved in that? Because that's a huge project. I didn't realise.
Yeah, I'm sort of leading a research project that underpins the programme. I really enjoy because it essentially brings all these different things together that I was sort of encountering as I was growing up. And this is, I think, quite an interesting thing about thinking about how far does what one does in academic work, so either in research or in teaching, in some ways, resonate with something one might have had as an interest as a teenager. And I've noticed this more recently is when I was a teenager, I picked up from a flea market a book by Sir Basil Spence, the architect Sir Basil Spence, called The Phoenix. And it's about the rebuilding of Coventry Cathedral. So in Coventry Cathedral, and this whole story about retaining the ruins, the reconciliation narrative, the symbolism of the new architecture is created next to the ruins, so they're retaining the memory and then using this as a symbol of reconciliation on a global scale. And that is something that I picked up recently when I was asked by the journal called Theology to write a little piece on actually the story of Coventry. And this becomes actually quite, in some ways, quite a personal story because this is the incredibly brave acts that the provost of the cathedral at the time to actually ask not to retaliate on the call and make this to proclaim this message of reconciliation at the time when Britain was in war with Germany, which is quite a brave thing to do and quite an emotional thing to do, because it was that actually my grandmother, she was in Dresden when Dresden was bombed. She was on the last train out of this, out of Dresden. So there's something really interesting that I am essentially here as an academic in the UK and I'm writing about something that is actually connects.
Everything you've just said is just making me think that we often don't know what those personal connections are until later on. And the things that maybe just seem very humdrum when we grow up, we hear stories, we don't understand them, we don't know the context of them, but then they really hit you. And I think they often hit you when the people concerned are no longer with us. And that, I mean, that's hugely, powerful. I mean, I've often for many years wondered about, what it is to be an academic when sometimes, a lot of the theologians that I study are, often have those ivory tower labels. We sit in our offices, we write on them, we critique their arguments, we tear them apart. But, how does that relate to the business of living? But what you've just shown is that important connection between the things that you're studying and the personal dramas and history and the legacies that come before them. And how this is more than an academic study. This is actually something necessary in terms of, not least, trying to understand the past and ensure that those scenarios, those horrible events that you've recounted, don't happen again. And actually to be part of that picture and find how you can make a contribution to that is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, I find it this piece, because I then also did as a result of this piece, I gave a talk at the cathedral. I was invited to talk there on the subject. And then I also was invited to do a sermon at Blean Church, where Stacey is actually an assistant priest working with Stephen Laird. And this is actually also quite interesting, because there's another dimension, which is actually the element of faith.
Yeah.
So this is not just an academic exercise, but actually what I'm really interested in writing about Coventry is there is a architectural story, there is a socio-cultural story, there's a historical story, but there's also a theology in it, which I find incredibly powerful and meaningful. Yeah. and incredibly relevant today. In seeing in a world as where actually polarization is becoming increasingly visible, and even if some of the polarization doesn't necessarily end up in armed conflict, although we're seeing that flaring up at the moment as well, is worrying that actually this and that people are able to capitalize on these divisions for their own benefits. So that's why I find that story of Coventry actually is something that's not historical. It is actually something incredibly living. In the message is still a living thing. And that's why I find actually history for me is not actually something studying something about the past, but it's actually a means of making sense of the present.
Yeah.
And also thinking about the future. So sustainability might be a contemporary issue, but if we're looking back in past, we can develop a new historical perspective on the roots of the dilemma that we are in now with protecting our planet and so on, and living in a sustainable manner on this planet. So to seeing where did all these developments that led to this situation, where do they come from? What was driving it? What were people's perceptions and aspirations that led to these developments? And why is it so difficult to unshackle ourselves now from these ingrained ways of doing things? Because very often they shake up people's particular perceptions. This is probably one of the biggest challenge.
I think that's so important. And actually, one of the reasons why I was drawn to the Nostalgia Project. I mean, maybe at the very beginning, I was thinking, gosh, you know, how do we relate to the past? But actually, the question is more fundamentally, how do we relate to the present? Because it's that sense that maybe we once had something or we don't have it now, or there's something in our present that we feel needs to be rearticulated, or there's something missing, or there's something that we need to flesh out or fill out. And, you know, it's going backwards, but also going forwards in terms of not necessarily literally rebuilding, although that's one aspect of nostalgia, but that sense of trying to really make sense of our own histories and identities. And I find that often those things that when we're young, you mentioned, you know, the flea market when you were a teenager, but those maybe things that seemed a bit random at the time, or those things that or the things that might have been a bit obsessional, but which somehow really come into their own. It's very easy to find retrospectively patterns and to say, you know, it's almost as though, you know, whether you grew up in Germany or in my case in Wales or wherever you do, you know, that there's a sense in which you would have followed the same kind of journey because it's in you. It's a driver, and that is the reason why often we're able to sustain, to use a term that you've used, but in a different context, but to sustain those kind of careers, because we have this thirst to try and extrapolate, this thirst to try and make sense of these things that are as much personal as they are scholarly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, but currently I find the most harder thing, and I would say for me personally, this feeling started probably around the time of Brexit. Because for me that was a break line where my experience of the UK, the Britain that I knew, didn't exist anymore. And there were a few moments where this so for me it's still really, I feel really is like almost like, and there was a moment where I actually were thinking, is there still a future for me in this country?
Yeah.
I was really seriously pondering about that. Because of that changing climate, and that is sort of really a sort of a question of identity, isn't it? I mean, you know, we are in the present now. What is the present now? And there's this, for me, in my lifetime, because I haven't been around that long compared to maybe like Louise, who you interviewed, you know, who had a much longer life, and I've probably more experienced cycles of reinventing, etc. But the what I find really interesting is, how do I now reframe myself in the context of a Britain that's no longer what it used to be, what I experienced in terms of the values, etc. So that actually links up, I think, very clearly with this whole idea of having a long-term perspective on things.
And actually that is crucial, because Brexit, I think, wrong-footed a lot of people, because it did lead, you know, I mean actually, and I think that this may have applied in your case, but, you know, the number of people I know and work with who were from Europe, who then, you know, needed to get British citizenship, and suddenly they were like, oh, you know, up to that point, it was, you know, we're all part of Europe. It was the UK's European University in those days. And there was just that sense that we're all part of this, you know, great, big, you know, wonderful, all-embracing, diverse continent. And then suddenly it was like, oh, no, you need a different kind of strategy if you're to continue doing what you've been doing so wonderfully up to this point. And so it did, I think, make an awful lot of people, the fact that the pandemic then hit while all of this was going through, didn't help either, because, you know, that sense of isolation on multiple levels, that from, you know, Brexit was a divisive and isolating thing for people, particularly who have to think, you know, hang on, where do I fit in? Do I belong here? But also then we're all plunged into this long period of, you know, a year or so of isolation. And I think, you know, when the history books are written, or they're being written now, you know, this is one of those sort of periods that on both counts nobody really saw coming.
It's really interesting. Is, I mean, my growing up with, because I mean, I have, so my grandparents, you know, spoke a lot, and sometimes they could only speak a certain amount of time, because it's very painful to have gone through all the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
But they talked about it. And this is apparently not the thing that happens in all families. Some people just do because it's too difficult.
Yeah.
I had, luckily, grandparents who would talk about it regularly.
Yeah.
I mean, the family generally talked about it because it shaped people's life and outlooks. Because my grandmother's incredible will to live, not to be stuck in this way of thinking that the past is always better. You always hear people making up this. Because if you have gone through that, you put things into perspective.
Yeah. And I think that the risk, and it shows that that's a very enlightened family, because, you know, Brexit also showed the side of people where there was this fear of embracing something different and unusual. And also this, I think, crazy notion that somehow the past was this sort of wonderful place. I mean, I often, you know, there's a part of me that, I'll give you one example. I grew up, you know, I went to university in the early 90s, and the things that we just took for granted, the films that we watched, the things that we did, from the point of view of being somebody who was lucky to go to university or privileged to go to university, it was all, you know, a great experience. But then you think, what about the people who were not, who didn't have the same opportunities? And the films that we watched were often very much of, you know, like ancient scriptures and the Bible even, you know, they're written by people who are privileged, the people who have those luxuries that not everybody has. And so we because we weren't aware of, and we weren't reading about or watching films about minority perspectives, we didn't think about them. And years later, you think, oh, my word, you know, I've met people who are doing exhibitions based on the, you know, the unknown voices, or the voices that are not heard, the faces that are not seen. And they were still there, but they just weren't where we were looking for them. And I think that can prompt guilt, that sense that somehow we had very blinkered horizons. So there may have been privileges and opportunities in the past that we look back to and think, you know, these were better days. But better for whom? That's the question. And I feel an intense sense that actually the things that I just took for granted, even when I'm teaching my students now, and the language that's used, the very male-centred language, or sometimes the very exclusive language in text that we just took for granted 30 years ago, now in a class where I might have students from different ethnic backgrounds, or my students are predominantly female, this male-centeredness is something that is not okay. But we would have once upon a time have just sort of, you know, taken it for granted because that was the way people wrote. But yeah, that was the way that the people who wrote, who were the privileged ones who could propagate those particular sensibilities. And that's just me reflecting in a teaching context. My own lecture notes, sometimes there are things in there that I, you know, if I was writing those lectures now, if I've still got, you know, stuff that I wrote 5-10 years ago, you know, I would present very differently now.
I mean, what I find interesting is, I mean, having this story, and I try to get back to with my grandparents, talking about their experience of what happened in the 30s and 40s, because in terms of Europe, so growing up in Germany, you're surrounded by countries, you have bound borders with lots of different countries, and you cross them.
Yeah.
So the thing about this, so I have a really strong sense of living, you know, growing up, living in a continent, and, you know, living on the European continent, going on the summer holidays, taking a rucksack with friends and taking an Interrail ticket. and go around Europe very cheaply, getting from one campsite to another, on all parts of Europe. So that gives you really a sense, you know, that this, and also actually how much you share in common. You see the differences, but you also see the things you share in common, and you also see the wounds of what happened in the two world wars, wherever you go, whether you go to Belgium, the Netherlands, Eastern Europe, you see evidence of this in the physical environment. So, and these marks, to me personally, these marks that we have there are showing us a time when these countries weren't in unity with one another, but actually fighting each other.
Yeah.
And this is what, from my grandparents' perspective, they're showing they have lived through a very severe version of that. And now you have people who want to go back to that sort of isolated imperialist view of countries being these isolated sovereign units. And as soon as that comes, you get suddenly these frictions and tensions going, and which is a root cause of all those conflicts in the first place. So for me, that has a more, it's not just an event that happens about the now, but it's actually quite significant. The European Union grew out of a movement, out of the Second World War, out of the tragedy of the Second World War, in order to finding a different way of living together.
I mean that notion of living history as well, that notion that, with my students this morning, we were looking at a couple of theologians from the Second World War and the relevance to today. And in many ways, of course, it's just as relevant, because the issues, the context, the historical events may be different, but the world around us is actually not that different. And the conflict, you know, there are still conflicts in the world, they might be in different parts of the world, but actually they're not that far away either in terms of everything that we've just been talking about in Europe. And I think it's very sobering, because, you know, I always used to think, when you're studying history in a school context when we were young, it was always like, well, are we learning this for what purpose? Are we just learning it because it happened, and in some way we need to know it because it is important for its own sake, or does it in some way resonate with us? And that's what I mean for any study. That's why from the very beginning you made it very clear about why architecture and sustainability is so important for you, and that's come up very clearly. But why do we do the things that we do? Do we do it because somebody tells us we have to know it, or does it impact on us? People who went to school at a very young age, you know, when they were maybe even primary school, but at the age of 11 or 12, they're studying Shakespeare, and maybe they, at the time, they're not ready for Shakespeare, and they might then feel, oh gosh, you know, they associate it with learning something in a school context and being assessed for it, and maybe getting marks they may not have liked, etc., for their assessments. And then many years later, they might go back to it and say, no, you know, now that I'm out of that zone, I can appreciate it for what it is. And I think that is the big question. We come back to things sometimes that, you know, when we're ready to do so and at the right time in our life, rather than because somebody is prescribing that to us. And I find that it's that interplay between, you know, there's the old adage, isn't there, that we always turn into our parents or something, or later years, you know, we resist our parents when we're young, but then we become them. And then to witness that and to see it in your own life is again, a very sobering analysis.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about coming back to things, I find this is something, this one example of Coventry was one example, but a feeling that actually in retrospect, now looking into, one always wonders, why did I pick the topic I did in my PhD?
Yeah.
I don't know, what did I do in my BA in architecture? I don't know, why are the themes that I picked up on there? And then one looks back now, they're feeling quite organic, they don't feel like contrived.
Yeah.
Because I guess in higher education study, you have a certain degree of agency over the content of your projects. Because certainly in architecture, the projects become quite personal endeavors as much as they are to me learning outcomes that the institutions are imposing on you. So in some ways we have, as architecture students have that one advantage, they are the creative endeavor, where their personality, actually personal journeys, might come through quite a bit in the way they approach a project, what they choose to do. And interestingly, in my PhD, which actually looked at the environmental history of glass buildings, So the idea of creating a building out of glass and understanding it from an environmental perspective. So how do these buildings were originally designed to live with the climate conditions in which they were designed in? So that is picking up an interest in the environmental aspect of an industrial type of architecture that I was growing up with. In hindsight, if I guess, and also they're looking at sort of unconventional building typologies like exhibition buildings, they're only meant to be temporary, greenhouses in botanic gardens like at Kew, or shopping arcades that were built in the 19th century with glass enclosures around them, etc. That I think sort of makes sort of sense because they're part of a sort of slightly unusual heritage.
Well, it's the journey that never ends. I mean, it's clear from what you're saying that you're never going to run out of projects that you want to embark on. And also what you're doing in Parliament, for example, is obviously a long-term one, isn't it? Because how long is it going to take for them I don't know if rebuild is the right word, but do all the transformation work with the Palace of Westminster?
That's a very good question because I don't think nobody really knows how long that eventually will take. So I'm been in the project, I've been working, so I've been seconded to Parliament for 7.5 years now.
Wow. Yeah.
So, and I've been working on the subject for just over 11 years. So I'm an academic, started off just purely writing about academically.
Yeah.
So writing, doing a little, was while I was doing my PhD, so this there's a story behind it. So during my PhD, I was sort of looking at historic ways of thinking about climate and the environment. And what I've noticed is when I was reading in contemporary sources from the 19th century, there were always regular references to the Palace of Westminster being this building that was technologically, environmentally highly innovative. You might not think that when you're looking at the building today and looking at the skyline of the building and seeing those ornamental towers, etc., that this building has actually anything to do with technological innovation, but that is very deceptive. So I was doing archival research and uncovering that actually behind this veneer of the Gothic Revival was an incredibly sophisticated ventilation and climate control system that is woven through the entire fabric of the building. And in terms of the scale and complexity, this was groundbreaking at the time. So this building became essentially a treasure trove for the study of the development of environmental technology and design principles. And is very well documented. So I was actually able to then, through the research, uncover actually the environmental intelligence, if you might describe it as, behind that design. And then being seconded to the project, I could study the building itself, not just through archives, but actually going around through voids in the building, through tunnels that were used for part of the ventilation and climate control system, a Victorian system that is no longer in use at the moment, but using archival research, etc., to uncover an understanding of actually why the building was built and designed the way it was, and realizing this building wasn't just purely about representation. It was also a showcase of technological innovation in terms of construction, environmental design, and also fire safety. Another aspect I'm working on at the moment, understanding historic principles of fire safety as they were applied to the building in terms of construction and design. So that the building has all that environmental legacy and heritage in it, and that's been sort of overlooked. So this project is now possible to actually work with these principles and directly looking at those modern solutions that can be integrated with that. Yeah.
And do you have unfettered access to the Palace of Westminster? Do you go there regularly? Are you able to access parts that other people don't have access to?
Yeah, that's part of the project. Yeah. So we've got a special security clearance for that. And I'm seconded, so I'm spending 3 days each week in Parliament on these projects. Some of it involves actually studying the building, going around, discovering even sometimes forgotten spaces that they were actually just there to move air around the building, just to give a sense of scale. You know, these are not just a few tubes in the walls. Of course, they were also part of it, but there were whole floors inserted in chambers and rooms into the fabric of the building. It was just there to collect air and move them out of the tower. So when you're looking at the towers of the building, so you're seeing lots of spires, they were actually part of the ventilation system. So to exhaust heat, hot air and smoke from the building.
How long did it take them to build the Palace of Westminster?
35 years.
Yeah.
So from the competition through to completion, although one could argue when was the building ever completed or was it ever completed?
Yeah.
Because a building like this. Yeah. So, and the interesting thing is now comes then, So studying the 35 years and records, and then also seeing what happened to the building after it was completed. So what is its history of change over time? Why is it in the state it is in at the moment? Where did that come from? So I've been studying this longitudinal history, essentially 180 years of history of the building in use, as a design and use, and seeing really how this environmental thinking kept evolving. Yeah. The building was in use, how they adapted the building, so the building wasn't a static artifact. So it kept being modified and improved on environmentally by staff that didn't have a voice before. We're talking about voices. Yeah. Part of my research, I've got a strong interest in talking about people who were not necessarily traditional architects or engineers in the history of architecture, but who might have been the facilities managers who played a central role in making the building work operationally. Mm. The type of police staff or attendants that were involved in making a building work that relied essentially on human labor to be responsive to changes in occupancy, changes in the climate outdoors, etc. So weather changes. The building needed to be responsive to that. So that was all done. So they'll be able to go into the archives to uncover actually these hidden stories and names of these people and roles these people held to making a building work. So not just the architectural grand vision, but actually what was the practice of architectural environmental control delivered by these people. Yeah. In the public building, luckily, you have got all the records of that. Yeah. So you can...
Well, I've got to ask, because as we start to wrap up, I haven't even asked a question which often comes up perhaps earlier on about things about, you know, growing up outside of all of the sort of interests that have led to your academic career. But what was, for example, the music that you grew up listening to? For me, this is always the question from childhood, because I always had this huge interest in what people were talking about in the playground at school, the charts on the radio, the music charts. What, you know, what was the sort of the things at the time? There'd be this competition in school almost, and that sort of competitiveness, almost like the validation of our particular types of music. Did you have anything like that growing up? Was there this sense that, you know, the culture around you, the popular culture around you, you know, really impacted on you and perhaps has carried forward to this day?
That's a very good question, actually, because I had never really had a very much a strong interest in the popular culture of my time I was growing up in. I was really interested in popular cultures of the past. And this is interestingly, because my dad has a large shelf full of records. Yeah. And these records, was a lot of this was 1960s music, and I loved it. So it was at that time that I really loved the Beatles. Yeah. Really love still to this day. Incredible music. And for me, they're actually not historical. I find that they're still very inspiring music. So there would have been things that I would have come across that I guess would have been through that, would have been like Michael Jackson. So very popular. So if you think about really mainstream popular culture, would have been Michael Jackson, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, a bit of ABBA. But whilst the type of contemporary music, I mean, in terms of contemporary music, was probably more late teenage years, when the sort of techno scene, and one particular music I was interested in is like the Prodigy, the Chemical Brothers.
Yeah.
So, we would come on really in the scene from the sort of late 90s, early 2000s. So I end of school, just the final years of school, and then the first university years. That is the type of music I'm still enjoying today and occasionally listen to even to this day. But classical music is another thing that shaped me a lot. And this is something that both Stacey and I share a lot in common, actually, that we hear quite a bit of classical music live, so Royal Albert Hall, etc., and sometimes locally in the Marlowe Theatre, hearing music, or go to Royal Festival Hall, etc.
It's beautifully integrated, actually, because what your answer to the question about the music you grew up listening to, is... Which I asked, by the way, because for me, there was always that fear, maybe on my part, am I wasting my life? Am I getting, you know, this? I was always obsessed with, you know, listening to the radio, writing all these things down, having this archive. Of course, these days there are plenty of archives, but in those days it didn't. It felt that, you know, if you missed it, it was gone. You know, because we didn't have the sort of ability to archive things in a digital way that obviously now we just take for granted. But those things somehow matter, and they matter no less now after 40 years. When people pass away, when people that we, or the artists, I mean, some, you know, that you've mentioned are no longer with us, then somehow the fact, you know, that these are not just historical curiosities. They existentially matter to us. And that's something that I think carries forward. But the question I wanted to ask was whether you'd be surprised, or your younger self would be surprised at what you're doing, because this integration between, you know, the previous generations, the whether in answer to the music question or in terms of your work with architecture and sustainability, you're always looking backwards in order to then bring it forwards and see how it impacts on today. Do you think your younger self would be surprised, or would be entirely delighted to sort of see the journey that you have taken?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is I don't feel there's a disintegration between my teenage self and my current self.
You don't think there is?
No.
Okay.
Because it's something that's been just purely just... There were certain things that were triggering me thinking about that a little bit over the last couple of years. And what I find really interesting is that there were things that I'm now doing are very much what I was interested in when I was growing up. So, for instance, it was just manifests itself in a slightly different way. And I wonder whether this is a nice thing maybe to saying is, when we're thinking about current generations, if we want to communicate sustainability to the people who today, like Fridays for Future, who are going on the streets and asking for the changes necessary to protect us from climate change and for us to just and live with our planet in a more harmonious way. That's a form of activism. These people will grow up, eventually will ask themselves, how do you take that passion, which I had as a teenager? I was reading all sorts of environmental literature at the time, going to sort of events and things like
that. And was that atypical? In other words, were you doing that in a way that you knew that maybe your contemporaries weren't doing? Or was that sort of, even at the time, did that seem unusual? Were you already carving out, maybe you didn't know it at the time, obviously, but you were carving out an interest and a passion and a career, which was perhaps different from your peers?
And no, I wouldn't say so. There were enough people around me who actually had shared something in common. So at school, for instance, I went to an unusual school where there was actually quite a lot of people environmentally interested people. So I went to a Steiner school.
Ah, yes.
And we really enjoyed because of the holisticness, the holisticness of the education that I experienced. And I think that's probably, and thus reflecting back, is probably one important influence in actually my interest in the breadth of interest that I have, in which you can express in the field of architecture, where you can actually be somebody who uses their hands, there's somebody who can think, and also somebody can be creative.
Yeah.
And that these three things are not in isolated silos, but that if you bring them together, you're actually creating the toolkit to be a rigorous and creative architect, because essentially you need those three areas. And that helped me actually sustaining that interest. But it's interesting is that what I want to come back to is, so the Fridays for Future people who might be forming their own group to find that space, even if they come from the background, they are campaigners. So they're standing there as campaigners. And in some ways, even if I wasn't on the street necessarily at that time, but I was thinking like a campaigner. I was concerned about the environment, was reading what Greenpeace magazine I had subscription to, for instance. Mm. I think it was very informative. Magazine, and that really sustained that interest in sort of environmental issues on a number of fronts, and I'm still reading it up to this day, and even reading The Economist, for instance, or specialist magazines on this, just to keep always up to date in the same way I was done as a teenager. But what I find interesting is that's, in some ways we might argue, is that's the sort of campaign exploring one's identity self in the context of these things. On my AWS street, and once one leaves school and becomes an adult and makes a decision about one's life and wants to do professionally, etc., and how way one wants to live, even, there is this important thing to think about: how can one transfer this onto the create a platform, essentially using one's work as a platform to channel those interests, and without actually necessarily this being planned. So I have to say this isn't planned in a conscious manner, but I can see that this happened in my case, that I was able to take those strands that I see as a teenager exploring meanings and position to the world, how those then come through in the work that I'm doing in all sorts of different ways. And that's what young people might be thinking about when they go into school and finish and go to university or whatever route they take, if they do an apprenticeship. Yeah. To think about is how could this thing doesn't become an isolated campaign issue, but it's actually something that you can make a real difference practically by getting involved and establishing a sustainable crafts business or something. So if you do an apprenticeship in joinery, you might think about, oh, can I create a sustainable business of joinery? Or if I go to university, I might think about policy to know where sustainability development goals are core to the curriculum, so that I find really quite an interesting journey of how does that interest manifest itself, always ways of continuity, ways that which does not break, to know how did this sustain itself through. And this is effectively essentially a metamorphosis. I would describe it as a metamorphosis into something that's primarily an interest, into something that becomes a subject of your practical work in teaching and research and practice. Yeah. And then actually starts to make a real-world impact.
Well, I've got one more question, and in so many ways, because you've given some answers that are so enriching, and you've undoubtedly covered this already, but would you consider yourself, Henrik, to be a looking back or a looking forward type of person?
I would describe myself as somebody who is looking back to look forward person. Yeah. Because I'm not interested in promoting a way of looking at the past, a way of returning to something. And one of the good things is about historical research, it brings it in, it gives you an understanding of the reality of what is actually going on rather than the type of illusions that sometimes people have. So you have a more critical, realistic understanding of what people did in the past to then reevaluate that and to inform a way of thinking about the future. So always thinking about it needs to be always in the present, understand the present conditions and seeing what one can do in the present to make a better future, while then also maintaining a connectedness to the past of which it is part of. Mm. So this past is not dead, it is actually part of something that's going on now, is they intimately, organically intertwined. So
amazing. I mean, there's a rich tapestry running through your work, and it's obvious that the journey is a very edifying one, but also a journey that has so many permutations and opportunities, and I can't wait to find out how the research and the work you're doing with the Palace of Westminster is going to unfold. But Henrik, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you, Chris.